You are listening to How Do We Make It Better, the podcast where we explore how people in nonprofits, corporations, social enterprises, politics, and other walks of life try to make it better. Get this where all quality podcasts are found. Links to all those places are at bit.ly/How Do We Make It Better Podcast, or if that's too long, bit.ly/HDWMIB. You can also check us out at dougabdiel.com. That's dougabdiel.com. This episode largely speaks for itself, so I won't give it a very long intro. I just ask that, again, as with all the people who I bring on here, that you address this with an open mind. Look at the quality of the ideas that Ben presents about Epic Charter Schools and about the way that he's trying to make the world a better place. You might not agree in the end, and that's okay, but I think he makes a very reasonable and reasoned argument for the way that he's trying to make the world better and the political lens that he views the world through. I challenge you to listen all the way to the end and see whether or not he doesn't dispel some preconceived notions that you have about education and perhaps about politics. Again, I ask that you'd simply just hold them to the same standard as you would hold anybody else who I bring on here, as I try to do, and not shut him out because he might have different political leanings than you do, or not embrace the ideas that he is putting out solely because he might fall on the same part of the political spectrum as you do. I think in the end, he's absolutely right that the way that we are going to improve most things in the world is by having reasonable conversations about them, not through shutting one another out. And I challenge you to take this as a first step in that. Ben, I want to thank you for taking the time out of your busy schedule to come talk to me today. I must admit, personally, I am really looking forward to hearing what you have to say about the ways that you're trying to make the world better. I've never had anybody involved directly in education, especially early childhood education, on this podcast. And I know it's a topic that's near and dear to just about every parent's heart. So thank you for taking the time to join me. Why don't you, in your own words, just take a minute and tell the listeners who you are?
Great. Thanks. Appreciate the opportunity. My name's Ben Harris. I'm actually a 1996 Truman Scholar, which is how you and I got to know each other through the Truman Network. I currently am a co-founder of a group of charter schools and run a charter management organization that has about 13,000 students under our management across four schools. Those four schools are in two states. One of them is in California, and the other three are in Oklahoma. The three in Oklahoma, two of those schools are charter schools. And then another of the school is actually a what's called a conversion school in Oklahoma, which is actually a traditional brick and mortar school that is chosen to convert their school to a charter school, which gives them the regulatory status of a charter school and then allows them to partner with an organization like ours to manage the school. We're in our seventh year of operation. We serve grades pre-K through 12. It's been a great experience. We started the school wanting to create a blended learning model where students could have an individualized approach to their education combined with a flexible schedule. And it has grown beyond our wildest expectations. We started the school because my partner in this endeavor was looking for a school choice for his junior high student and really developed a school so he would have a place to go that my partner felt good about. And we were hoping that we would get 400 students because we weren't sure that we could make it financially sustainable without that number of students. And in our first year, we got 1,700 students, and we've grown very rapidly since then. And now we're in our seventh operational year and are serving 13,000 students, and we enroll about 60 students a day. So.
That's amazing. Plenty of startups would love that kind of growth trajectory over 7 years. That's amazing. While delivering pretty tailored services as well, that must be difficult. Look, from your perspective, I can understand why your partner got into it, but what brought you personally into it? Why is this an area that you are personally passionate about? I know you've got plenty of skills and could have dropped in doing any number of things. Why is schooling, education generally, and charter schools more specifically, something that you're passionate about?
Well, a combination of two things. One, I got involved in online education about 17 years ago when I started an online learning company. That company provided turnkey services for fully instructed virtual courses for traditional school districts. And in doing that, although it was a great experience, we ended up selling the company to DeVry in 2007. We also learned that instructionally and also operationally, it had some gaps. We just felt like that instructionally that it worked well for some kids, but other kids, there were pieces that were missing that if filled in, we could have helped a lot more students. And we also learned that when you're a vendor to a school, you have a lot less control than when you are the school yourself. So there are a lot of times that we sold our product to a school, but the way that it was implemented, we feel like didn't really reach its full potential. So when I decided to re-enter this space, we had two goals. One, I wanted to create an instructional model that filled the gaps of my former experience. Secondly, I wanted to create something that was a competitive force and that would really provide in a scalable way something that would be competition to other public schools to make those public schools better. So one of the requirements with our school is we've never turned away a student. We have scaled and part of that is we're not tied completely to facilities. So our growth is easier to scale because we don't fill up, if you will. We use the public infrastructure in the community to meet with our kids face to face. So our scale is really limited by our ability to hire good people and get them trained to serve. So that was the other thing that we decided is that we didn't want to be a vendor. We wanted to actually be a school. So instead of starting a company, we started a school and a charter management organization so that we could actually manage the school and have the operational control for our families. And those have all proven to be pretty good choices, and it's worked out really well. And it's just something that, you know, we're privileged to do and super passionate about, and, you know, just excited to come to work every day and pretty flattered by the fact that so many families have trusted us to educate their children.
That's fantastic. So maybe for those who aren't used to the term of art, those who are listening from overseas about what charter schools is, maybe I can play it back to you and you tell me what is different about a charter school. As I understand a charter school, it is a public school that has to enroll anyone from the community. There's no additional fees, but it has its own method of educating them and can adapt the more traditional teaching model in ways that it thinks are useful to provide what you, in your own words, call a competitive force to the market that pulls all the other public schools up by dint of the competition that you've got going for your students. Is that about right, or is there something I've missed about what charter schools are?
No, I think you're pretty close. Three things I would kind of add to your definition is typically charter schools are public schools that are privately managed. You're right that they charge no tuition. They have to admit all students unless their capacity is full, at which time they have to conduct a lottery for who gets in and who doesn't. We've never had to do a lottery because we've never turned a student away. The other thing about a charter school is typically they are more lightly regulated than a traditional public school, and they typically have a trade-off for a higher level of accountability for a lower level of regulation. So other than those, you know, additional components, I think you really defined it quite well.
Okay, makes a lot of sense to me. So can you talk to me about, maybe before we move on to how you're planning to scale and get even bigger, just what the state of education in Oklahoma was? Like, how big is this as a problem in terms of, you know, there are lots of things that people could invest in, right? It costs about $1,500 to save a human life from malaria. There are, you know, cancer treatment. There's lots of other things that you can invest in. Why is childhood education such a big problem in the area that you're looking at, or more generally? Like, why is this something that we should care about?
Well, we educate grades pre-K through 12. So we educate everything from a four-year-old to a 20-year-old when students age out of our program. And as far as its level of importance, I think that what we've tried to focus on, we really, our growth has happened organically, and it's happened largely from referrals from our families encouraging other families to go to our school because they've had a good experience. We're really not very good marketers. You know, we do a little of that, but we certainly don't focus on it. We've tried to, after we got through year one, which was quite an adventure, just learning so much and having way more students than we ever thought possible in that first year. From year two on, we have really tried to be very, very focused on quality. And our approach to growth is simply saying, we're in a space where quality begets quantity. And if we do a good job, growth will happen naturally. And I'm really glad we did that because one, what we do is difficult and you can always do better in education. Even if you feel like you're doing things right and you're doing good work, there's always room to improve. And so we just try to get better every year at what we do. And the growth has sort of been a byproduct of that. As far as, you know, the need and sort of why this is my passion and why I think it's important is I think the mark of a good public education system should be that, you know, no matter where a student lives or how much money they make, they have the ability to choose a school that's not only a quality school, but a school that meets their needs. Something we say often around here is that students are entitled to a good school, but a school is not entitled to students. Every student that comes to our school, their family has to choose to do so. We don't inherit any students based on a geographic, you know, monopoly or anything like that. So we have to sort of earn the trust of our parents in the way that we do business. And we feel like that's sort of the ultimate accountability for any school. And the reason I think it's so important is public education is really what sets our country apart. And I think that, you know, not only doing that in a way that's quality, but figuring out how to do that typically in an environment when you're in public ed where resources are quite scarce. I live in a state in Oklahoma where we're one of the lowest per pupil funding states in the country. Our average per pupil expenditure in our state is about $8,500. Our school, because of some of the quirkiness of our funding laws, we actually get around $4,800 per student. So even in a low funded state, we have to make do with a lot less money. And so a lot of what we have tried to build is to create value, and even in a lower cost environment with less money to spend, to try to deliver parents just as good of a product or better than what they can get in their neighborhood school. So I think that's important. I think that even that in a space where you're trying to improve constantly, you really never can have enough resources. So to me, a lot of what public education about is doing the best you can with what you have and delivering value with the resources you have, as opposed to, you know, sort of simply pining for more resources and saying, boy, if I had this, I could do X. I mean, we just feel like that's not a very good use of our time. There's a lot of people in our state advocating for more money for public education. We want them to be successful and we wish them well, but we try to spend most of our time and energy focusing on what money is available for us to do our job with and then making those dollars go as far as we can.
That makes sense. Look, I guess there's two things I'd love to ask you, and I'm happy for you to take them in either order. One is around metrics for success, both kind of the tangible metrics that you might imagine, like I know the Ohio Public Skills Test or the California Public Education Skills Test. I don't know how you fall out on those rankings and whether or not that's what you use to determine value. Maybe we can just answer that. Like, what do you consider to be success, or how do you benchmark yourself?
Well, we have about five things that are sort of our high level metrics. And one is we feel like student growth is a success factor. We feel like if families are choosing us and we're being determined by more and more parents that we are the right choice for their student, that in and of itself is the ultimate metric of success. So student growth is one. Secondly is the number of teachers that are interested in working for our school. One of the things we're really proud of is we pay teachers about 20% above the statewide average in our state. And as a result of both that, as well as what we think is a really high quality workplace and a lot of professional development, we have about 15 applicants for every opening we have in a state that's really suffering from almost a crisis level of teacher shortage. So the attractiveness of our school to teachers and people in the education profession is an important metric. Thirdly, and these aren't in any priority order, they're just sort of the five things we try to measure and improve upon. Third thing is we're an ACT state. Most kids in Oklahoma take the ACT, not the SAT. So we look at how our composite, our average composite ACT score compares to both the state average and the national average. Over our history, we have typically been above the statewide average and about and tied with the national average. Last year, we were in the top third of ACT composite scores among Oklahoma public schools, even though we're dealing with, you know, 50 to 60% of the resource levels of a lot of our peer public schools. The other thing we look at is we measure a success with a student by one of two things, either a proficiency level in a state standardized exam or a what is called a normed learning gain, which we have a benchmarking tool that has normed data called NWEA MAP. It's a very pretty common benchmarking tool among public schools. And we use that and compare our data to norm data nationwide. And if we can generate a norm learning gain in a subject or a proficiency on a statewide exam for a state test eligible student, we consider either or of those to be a success. If we can't do one of those two things, we consider it a failure. And we try to, you know, keep our failure rate as low as possible. The last thing, which is something we've just folded in the last 12 months, is what we call the Next Step program. And we measure how many of our seniors are either going into the military, are working, are doing an internship, or are in concurrent enrollment classes as a senior, meaning they're taking college courses, or they're in career tech or vocational courses. We feel like if one of those five things is being done by our seniors, that those kids are going to be ready for what comes after their diploma. And in our view, depending on the kid, any of those five directions can be a quality direction if there's been thought put into it and the student, you know, finds happiness in one of those five areas. So we measure and we try to help this student make that decision and then support them in the choice that they make.
That makes a lot of sense. One follow-up to that before I move on. The first two metrics that you mentioned about student growth and teachers willing to come work for you, if somebody has a critical eye on this, they could look at something like, well, turns out that people clickbaity things on Facebook or the, you know, look what happened here, I bet you won't know what's coming next. Meaning sometimes people want things, but it's not what's good for them. I see you've trying to balance that out with metrics that come along for benchmarking you against other schools. But I guess, does that worry you at all that sometimes people want what isn't good for them? Does that make sense?
It doesn't worry me because I think that over time, particularly when it comes to their kids' education, people are pretty rational. You know, we have a fair number of families every year that choose our school and then decide for a variety of reasons that it's not the right direction for them, and they withdraw and go to a different school. And then we have other families that stay with us for many, many years. I have a lot of confidence, frankly, in families to make the right decision for their kids. In some ways, I think that if you don't have confidence in that, you know, our ability of, and you're in public service, your ability to manage your way out of a problem like a parent not making a good choice for their kids is really pretty minimal. I think by and large, the large, overwhelming majority of parents are conscientious about the educational choice they want to make for their student, and they're attuned and they are engaged, definitely at a variety of different levels, but certainly we have to work hard to earn that parent's trust and then to maintain it over time. We do lose students because we're not the right choice for a family, but by and large, our growth rates as a school have never been lower than 20%, and they've been as high as 49% in any given year. So more families are choosing us and deciding that we are the right fit than are not. And, you know, I believe in the wisdom of the masses much more than the wisdom of the few. And to me, that's validation. And really in any other sector, we don't micromanage the choices of the masses. As a matter of fact, we celebrate people for being validated by the choice of the masses. You know, movie stars, athletes, Amazon, Google, none of them, you know, have 400 people that are their customers that everyone's decided are smart enough to make good choices for themselves. They've been validated because, you know, thousands, if not millions of people have decided that they can deliver value in their lives. And to me, that is much more gratifying and much more credible than any small sample or academic study or highly educated elite academics validating you. I would much rather have the validation of thousands of parents. So to me, there's a really rational argument to be made out of it. I realize that sometimes people don't make great choices. My belief in really about everything I do is that over time, people either make good choices or they learn from their bad ones and ultimately make better ones.
That makes a lot of sense. So I want to back up, maybe zoom out a little bit here and talk about this rational choice thing and more ask you a question, Ben, around for you, the way that you're talking, you know, very similar to what you would hear in Schumpeterian creative destruction, free market economics. I have had other people on the podcast who are hedge fund managers who make very similar arguments about, well, look, I'm making the world a better place by allocating scarce capital. Why for you was this the area that impassioned you about? Maybe the best way to approach this is just using the old economics term, the opportunity cost. Like if you were not tomorrow, for whatever reason, able to continue on your work with Epic, what would you do? What is your next best alternative?
Well, gosh, you know, I've had three jobs I'm uber passionate about. The top two have been the one I'm in, which is by far my favorite, the best job I've ever had. The other one was when I was in government. I was the deputy secretary of a social services agency, and I really enjoy working in state government. Very different roles, but found a lot of passion in both of them. Yeah, as far as why this is my favorite and where I really think my calling is I really get an enjoyment out of competing. And I think it's, you know, not that I wouldn't find fun in another sector where I would compete against, you know, maybe a hyper competitive sector like banking or insurance or, you know, hedge funds, whatever. I may find a lot of joy in that. What I really like about education is, you know, last I checked, I think most estimates are that public education makes up somewhere between, I think, 10 and 20% of overall GDP. Pretty large sector, not quite as big as healthcare, but not much smaller. And I think what's unique about education in the country is it is largely a public monopoly, semi-socialistic type of environment, largely command and control, largely driven by public resources that are allocated by political subdivisions as opposed to privately managed competitors. And I think what attracted me so much to it is the fact that I felt like it was a sector that really needed competition. I mean, I feel like competition is the force that in many ways sets our country apart and does more to improve the lives of everyday people than even governments do. Even though I think governments really do a lot to improve the lives of people, I feel like it's a force that can improve education. And, you know, if I can be a catalyst to that, that's exciting to me, you know, and hopefully, and I've really already seen it, by competing for families, you are making your competitors better. And I see that all the time. And it's a very incremental process. But I see public schools get better because they don't want to lose families. They want to continue to exist. They want to continue to thrive. And if students are going away from your school, just like any enterprise, when people are leaving you, that's not a good thing for long-term sustainability. So you get better or you cease to exist. And I think that's a positive thing because the people that end up benefiting are the students and families that need the services.
Okay. That makes a lot of sense to me. Let's move on to kind of your overarching goal here and perhaps what's holding you back right now. If you can talk me through the plan for the next 1, 2, 10, you put whatever time horizon on it that you like, however you think through your own planning. What's holding you back from fixing education right now and doing this more effectively? I think you've made a pretty reasonable argument that competition makes the education sector better and that you're providing value versus just asking for resources. What's holding you back from doing this faster or more effectively?
Well, in the state in Oklahoma, where the bulk of our students are, I think one factor is there is a public policy item is funding equity. I think that if our school and really all schools were funded on an equitable basis, that would be a huge improvement for all schools. There would certainly be winners and losers, but I think overall public education would improve if districts and schools were funded on an equal basis on a, from a per pupil standpoint. So that's something we're actually part of an association that's part of a lawsuit right now to try to achieve that. So that's something in the near term that we think would certainly help our cause and would give us more resources to deploy and invest on behalf of our families. I think what we've really bought into and our philosophy is that there isn't, you know, education is something that is a continual improvement process. We don't think that it's something that in 5 years we will look up and say, oh, you know, aha, we fixed it. We hope in 5 years we will stand up and say, boy, we are so much better than we were in year two. We're so much better than we were in year seven. And we will say that every year. And 20 years from now, you know, we will have a long, long list of students that have had success and productive lives at least in part as a result of our contribution to their education. So we really look at it as a really long ball, long-term play. And that's something that we have, you know, every year we have disappointments, we have failures, and we have tremendous successes. We have honors. And we try to make incremental improvement every year. But it's, in our opinion, education is not something that is fixed because to me, you know, there are systems. Just one example, I know Massachusetts gets a fair amount of positive publicity as one of the better common education systems in the country. And I certainly think they have a lot to be proud of. But I can guarantee you there are kids and families in pockets and in schools in Massachusetts. Some of those schools may be considered successful schools. Some of them may be failing schools, but there are certainly families who are not getting their needs met by the Massachusetts public education system. So to me, it's much more about seeking out those individuals and trying to take that number as low as it can possibly go than it is to be able to brag about a macro list of statistics. And so that's really what we try to do. We try to focus on the individual. We try to focus on being student-centered and meeting the needs of kids on an individual basis. And that's sort of our mission.
I think you just said that I'm asking the wrong question, which I think is quite a reasonable approach here. You're taking kind of a Kaizen approach to education, something that we would more traditionally associate with some companies like Toyota or something like that, where you're continually refining the production and throughput, to use some terms from the manufacturing industry over here, to try and make sure that people's lives are improved overall, which I think is it's a very interesting approach. Look, maybe we can just move on to, if you've convinced others that this is an area that they really want to spend more of their own time and investment in, what can people who are listening do to help? How can they get involved with your school or more broadly in the charter school initiative overall, or just generally, what can others do to help? You are listening to How Do We Make It Better? Check us out at bit.ly/htwmib. That's bit.ly/htwmib.
You know, we have, we're different than a lot of our peers in the sense that we've actually never raised philanthropic dollars. We have gotten a few small grants, not many, but we largely operate off of the federal and state revenues associated with performing our service. So we don't typically go out and ask people to invest in us philanthropically. I think we'd certainly take that investment, and we have a lot of great things we could do with it. We just feel like our time is better spent on learning how to best allocate the capital we get as opposed to trying to attract more capital. And by growth, we will attract more capital anyway. So that's sort of how we look at it financially. You know, it sounds odd because it's not necessarily in my competitive interest, if you will, but I really think that the best way that people can improve education is, education is one of those things, it's kind of like politics or sports or something like that. Everybody seems to have a bit of an opinion on it. You know, most people have had some level of education in our country. and that's a blessing. Most people either went to school or have kids that go to school, but somewhere directly or indirectly, people feel connected, I think, to the public education system. So it's one of those things that you have a really diverse set of opinions on. And the other thing is it's kind of it's that congressional phenomenon. You know, everybody seems to be negative or critical of Congress, but they seem to like their congressman. And I think to a large extent, that's kind of true in public education. People are fairly critical and kind of negative with regard to public education, but yet they think that the school that their kid goes to is really pretty strong. So I say all that because I really think what would improve education more than anything is that if people think that they can do better, and if people feel like there is something lacking in the public education system, my advice to them is go start a school. We have charter laws in, I believe, 30 or 40 states now, definitely the large majority of our states. And we have the ability for people to effectively, on their own or as part of a team, start a school. And to me, when that door is open, I think it's a lot more effective if you can start a school and change the lives of 500 kids as opposed to, you know, advocate for policy positions that may or may not happen. And then they may or may not work if they do happen. I really would tell you, you're going to learn so much about education and you're going to be able to test your theories and decide if your ideas about making it better, about what people should do, what, quote, they should do with public education. Jump in there and get in the bathtub. The water's warm. And I would encourage people to start schools, volunteer for a school board, be a charter school developer, work as a teacher, but get involved. And I think that the charter school movement sort of allows an entrepreneurial opening to being involved in education that wasn't there 20 years ago. It was really kind of closed only to professional and career educators. So I think that would be the advice I'd give to people. If people take that advice, we'll have a lot more competitors. But I really think that the best way to improve education is to make sure that people have lots of choices and that they can find a choice that best meets their individual students' needs.
That makes a lot of sense. Let me ask you just, you touched on it briefly there, the certifications required for teachers in the past versus now, and just making a general call out to everybody in the audience, some of us who've got, you know, plenty of education ourselves but have never been professional teachers. Do you think that the certification standards for teachers are adequate, correct? Like, should we have this educational training program for educators? Should we require this type of certification for teachers? Or is in your opinion, that just not adding a whole lot of value?
You know, I actually would call it helpful, but not essential. We are not required by statute to hire certified teachers, but we do hire all certified teachers. Occasionally, we will have an area where it's hard to teach, like hard to find teaching talent, like foreign language or a high-level science or math course, where we will hire a uncertified professional and then ask them to get alternatively certified. But we find it helpful because it's one of those things that most of the time is indicative of kind of a minimum set of knowledge. But I really think that what we've had to really focus on as an organization is training teachers to teach in our model. And I think to a certain extent, most schools have some uniqueness to their model. So working on their own individual training programs, you know, similar to a corporate environment, you know, you want strong science and math schools. But that doesn't mean that Boeing or Google, et cetera, are going to not have their own internal training and professional development efforts. So I do think certifications add value. I think it's sort of a service to schools to know that a teacher, you know, achieved some minimal level of accomplishment in a subject area so that we can move forward. I don't think it's essential. I think there should be a lot of latitude with regard to people being able to enter the profession. One of the positive, I think, proofs of that is the Teach for America organization. I've not worked a lot with them, but I know a lot of education folks that have, and I really feel like they've kind of proven out that if you're a sharp, committed, and passionate person, you know, you can learn how to teach without a teaching certificate. So, you know, that would be my view on certification.
That makes sense. Look, before we move off of Epic overall, I'll just turn it over to you. Is there anything that I should have asked you about the charter schools that I haven't asked you? Is there, I guess I'm kind of just opening the floor to you to say anything that you feel like is left unsaid with respect to the primary way that you're trying to make it better?
You know, I don't think so. Kind of a different experience. We have a school in California and a school in Oklahoma. In Oklahoma, charter schools have become, they're a little bit more of a partisan issue. In California, they're really a bipartisan issue. I mean, there's really a fair amount of charter school advocates in both parties. You probably have a slightly, you know, more pro-Republican backer aspect, but not much. I mean, it's, I guess my thought is, I think that there have been, you know, many Democrat and Republican politicians that have backed charter schools. And to me, the aspect of charter schools that I think it warrants and merits bipartisan support is the fact that they have access. I mean, if charter schools are following the law, they're open to all students. And to me, whether a school is publicly or privately managed is really irrelevant. What really matters is what's the quality of work are they doing and are families finding value in them. And so I think the only thing I would say is, you know, for those that kind of see charters as, you know, they sort of attach it to a lightning rod figure like a Betsy DeVos or someone that's been a charter school supporter, you know, I would just encourage you to take a step back and look at it in a bipartisan way and in a nonpartisan way and ask yourself, is this adding value to families? And is this something positive? Because I really think that there's very little data that suggests it's not if you look at it objectively.
That makes a lot of sense as well. Look, let's maybe pivot, and you've done a tremendous job, I think, explaining your rationale as well as allowing me to seamlessly move over into this. I've had a very difficult time getting thoughtful conservatives who clearly care about making the world a better place on this podcast to talk about the ways in which they're trying to make it better. And from our conversations in the past, I believe that you would define yourself as a conservative. And I don't know if you'd call yourself a Republican or a Trump Republican or what brand you want to put on yourself. But that's really disconcerting for me, honestly. I feel like different portions of the American public have done just what you're talking about and kind of written one another off because you grab one partisan shibboleth and it's, oh, well, you're in that camp, therefore I'm just going to tune you out. And I don't personally think that that adds a whole lot of value to our political discourse. In fact, it makes discourse impossible. So I guess I would love to hear from your perspective, just in your own words, about your own political leanings and why you think it's still rational today to be whatever brand of conservative you'd like to label yourself, and why even in this environment you're willing to stand up and talk about the principles that you hold dear.
Well, you know, I'll be honest with you. Thanks for the question, but I'll be honest with you. For the first time, Doug, believe it or not, I've always been a pretty outspoken person and not really ashamed of my beliefs. But, you know, you look over what's happened in the country the last 12 to 18 months, and I got to tell you, you know, knowing that we were going to talk at some level, talk politics, for the first time, I actually had reticence. I started to think, you know, if I voice my beliefs, is it going to hurt my family? Is it going to hurt my business? You know, am I going to get boycotted? And just all the things that happen now when people seem to voice their political opinions. And it didn't deter me from showing up today. But I think that I really think it's both unfortunate. I think it's dangerous. You know, I don't know who said this, but something I was told by one of my professors, and it wasn't his quote, but he said that, and he was actually a Democrat, but what he said was, he said, the only thing worse than a world ruled entirely by Democrats would be a world ruled entirely by Republicans. And his point, and that's kind of a paraphrase, but his point was, is that absolute control or even dominant control by any one and singular school of thought is a dangerous thing in a democracy, and that we need dissent and we need real dissent and the ability to, you know, unite and block actions and make it difficult to have change and things like that. And that was the point he was making, is singular party control or dominant party control is not really positive. And I kind of agree with that. You know, Oklahoma, as an example, is struggling right now because they have a dominant party control, and that party's developed factions, and they're having challenges dealing with some policy problems. I'm not saying that they could do it better if it was more divided or split, but, you know, who knows? I think at the federal level, we've got actually pretty evenly divided government. Although every chamber in the executive is currently Republican, as you can see from the U.S. Senate, it's clearly divided. Clearly, there is not a governing majority that is able to pass things at their will. So what I think is unfortunate is when I was a Truman Scholar in the mid-90s, and when I went to TSLW, and I was probably out of a group of 70 scholars. My sense is I was one of half dozen Republicans, if I had to guess. I then went to grad school at the Maxwell School at Syracuse, and probably out of about 60 or 70 people in my class, that's a long memory. I think that's about right. I was, again, one of about a half dozen Republicans in my graduating class. Here's what I know. I have lifelong friends from both of those experiences. Very few of the lifelong friends I made are the same party that I am. More importantly, the experiences I had by having my thoughts and ideas challenged and debated and joked about and sharing humor, I'm not sure that goes on today. One, I think that institutions and organizations are more monolithic. And I think that the cheat in that is I felt like I had a richer experience. I felt like I had to sort of prove my ideas. I felt like I learned a lot. A lot of times people would, you know, argue with me and I'd have to concede a point. And the thing that I think is missing is I don't see anybody conceding that somebody makes a point. You know, I'll give you an example. I think that, you know, when you talk about repealing Obamacare and somebody says, well, what do you do when somebody that doesn't have insurance shows up in an emergency room? Do you let them sit in the lobby and die? I think that's a pretty good point. And although I'm not a real big fan of Obamacare, I think that's a really good point. And I think that the fact that the Republican Party doesn't have an answer to that point, or hasn't been able to get enough unification around an answer to that point among others, is a real shortcoming. And I think the same is true on the other side of the aisle. So, and I could come up with an example I picked on myself, but certainly there's examples of Democrats not conceding to Republican points. I mean, using the same analogy with Obamacare, Republicans have a really good point that, you know, these costs continue to go up and they're probably not sustainable. And we're probably on a path to a single payer system, which has its own set of downsides that'll come with it. So that's a good point. And I feel like instead of people conceding that somebody makes a point, they make it all about the personality. They make it about the individual. They attack and they say, okay, I don't like your policy position, so I'm going to try to dig dirt up on you and discredit you. And they ignore the fact that somebody makes a point. I mean, I think Donald Trump makes a really good point that you can't have a rich social safety net and an unlimited and uncontrolled immigration system and be sustainable. I think that's a good point. And when he makes it, he's typically called a racist. And I think that that's not a good thing. And I don't think Donald Trump's perfect, but I think he makes a point occasionally. And I think when people make a point, we ought to concede it and then try to have conversations and come up with solutions that recognize that the other side has a point. And even when you're in the minority, there can be components of a solution that you can contribute to. And I don't see that happening. And I think it's not a good thing.
So, I mean, help me understand, because this is my small effort to try and make it better. I don't know that I've ever expressed it on the podcast before, but my hope when starting this out was that I could alternate between the people that I spent a lot of my time growing up with and spent a fair amount of time in the military with, who were very conservative, who, like yourself, I find to be intelligent and relatively easy to talk to and do have reasonable points to make, and mash that together with kind of the coastal and overseas living that I've had later on, where I also meet people who tend to be much more liberal, but equally as you say, have points. They're intelligent folks. But somehow they don't talk to each other. Or when they do, it's to make this argument ad hominem that you're talking about. Where it's like, well, you would say that, right? And I don't know, how do we make this better, Ben? Like, how do we get back to a spot where we can have that kind of reasonable Socratic dialogue, where we can have this thesis, antithesis, synthesis of ideas, where in the battlefield of ideas, the best one rises to the top, and we all go home with a smile on our faces, not feeling like we're personally beaten down. How do we get to that point in civic discourse?
You know, I think, in my opinion, one thing that it's kind of mechanical, a little bit nerdy, but I really like federalism as an answer. I mean, I think one of the great aspects of our country, one of my favorite places on earth is California. I love the state. I love the weather. I love the people. I mean, I've had a lot of wonderful times in that state. And certainly the overwhelming political opinion of California is different than my own, but I really don't care when I'm, you know, wine tasting or doing business out there, any of those types of things. I enjoying the weather. I like the fact that our country is such that you can go from one state to another. And in many ways, they're very different places. And I really don't see the harm in being in Oklahoma and seeing somebody with a gun on their hip versus being in California and seeing somebody walk down the street with a joint, you know, smoking marijuana or whatever. To me, it allows people to sort of vote with their feet and, you know, live in a place that represents their values and they can make their own trade-offs, et cetera. So I think part of my challenge is I feel like at the federal level in particular, you know, it's all about I'm going to come up with a one-size-fits-all solution. And then if I win, you lose, and I'm going to get to shove it down your throat. Well, to me, one of the beautiful things of federalism is there's a lot of policy debates that the federal government can stay out of or delegate to the states way more than they currently do. And I think in some ways it would reduce division and it would allow people to sort of do what they want to do in their own backyard. And certainly there's going to be things where we have to have federal agreement and, you know, agreements that transcend state borders. But I think the federal government has entered itself into way too many issues where that is not the case. And it's really factionalized the country. So federalism would be a part of that. You know, I do think as far as, you know, policy wise, I really am a big fan of pretty much unlimited free speech. You know, I really believe that we should be as much as we're repulsed by what somebody says, we should defend to the hilt their right to say it. I think we're diminishing that. I think that people have their speech that's not comfortable. And so our reaction has been, how do we shut that off? As opposed to how do we simply fight it with more speech that is better speech, that's more informed speech, that's more persuasive, that's more influential, and let there be a battle of ideas. We've tried to shut people up. And so I think that's a piece of it. I don't know the answer. I will tell you, I think that both of our major political parties are really going through to say it's a remake, I think is understating it. I really feel like both parties are really having an identity crisis right now. And I think perhaps that the outcome of that shakeup and the outcome of that reorganization that's going on will go a long way to fix it. I'll tell you a shed of light. It's kind of odd to say this, but I think recently Donald Trump did a deal with the Democrats on the debt ceiling. I mean, that's the first time since, and I'm sure there's been others, but that's the first time personally that I can remember president doing something with the opposite party since the early to mid 90s. It was Gingrich, Clinton, et cetera. So, yeah, you know, I think that in some ways, the wild card aspect of Trump in the fact that, you know, he is more about what he thinks will improve the world than he is about what he thinks will improve the Republican Party. And the fact that if Republicans won't support that vision, he will pivot and get components of that vision that he can fulfill with Democrat cooperation. I feel like that going in both directions keeps everyone honest. And I think that, you know, the more we see of that, probably the better off we will be. Not just with the example of the current administration, but at all levels of government. So I'm hopeful that the remake going on in the parties will you know, kind of bridge what I think is a ridiculous level of disconnect between those that live in Washington and the rest of the country. It's kind of astounding.
Very interesting. Look, we're drawing close to time here. So I'd like to kind of just move on to a few rapid fire questions I like to round out with, unless you had anything else that you wanted to, I guess maybe I'll, before I do that, open up the same question I did before around your school to political ideology. Is there something that I should have asked you or a question that was poorly framed that you wanted to say to the people who probably listening to this podcast are largely on the left side of the political spectrum? And in your own words, just let them know. I think they would have all been convinced already that you're a thoughtful and caring person. Is there anything else that you want to say to them that we haven't?
Yeah, I think we've, one thing that concerns me is I feel like we've diminished the term racist, and we overuse the term. And to me, it's when you say that someone is that, it's serious. That doesn't mean it's not valid, but I think that it should be sort of reserved for situations that are overt and clear. I think it diminishes the term when we use it with people who probably are prejudiced, but I think that everyone at some level has some degree of prejudice, and that spans across race. So I worry that we are way too quick to devolve policy disagreements into issues of race. And I don't think that's a good thing. And I think what that does is it's almost like the equivalent in discourse of pushing the nuclear button. I think it, when, if someone looks at, if I do X, I could potentially be branded a racist, 9 times out of 10, people will just choose to be silent or to not engage and to keep their thoughts to themselves and go pull the lever and not be influenced and not try to influence others and then go pull the lever as they want to. And I don't think that's positive. So I think to me, we should be really reticent before we push the nuclear button in our discourse. And I used race as an example. I think there's other examples of it too. That would be kind of one. I've already said I think we ought to concede when one party or person with a different worldview makes a good point. I think we should always look for those. When you can let someone know they've made a point that's connected with you, I think that's always, they're more likely to maybe concede that you make a point too. And then the other thing I think is getting to know each other on a personal level. I mean, one of my dear friends, I'll give an example. We've joked about politics for years. This year after the election, I saw her and I knew she actually worked in the Obama administration. And I knew that she was a Hillary supporter. When I saw her after the election, I made some joke or crack about, you know, that the election had not gone her way. And she literally burst into tears. And I did not press it. I immediately dropped the topic. It was uncomfortable. But what I'd realized is that, you know, what we used to joke about and give each other a hard time about and have fun with, even though we knew it was serious and it was high stakes, you know, we tried to keep it in perspective and we tried to not ever let it, you know, be a barrier in our personal relationship because we knew who each other was, that I could no longer go there. And I just think that is politics at its core is people and it's trust and it is, you know, recognizing that someone has the same intentions that you do. They just likely have a different path of how to get there. And I really think that by not, you know, being able to engage people personally and have humor and joke about things and make fun of one another and make fun of ourselves, I think we are not remembering that people are at the center of politics. They make it go. And as policymakers and leaders, you know, we've got to recognize that we're smart people with different ideas. And that if the only people you talk to are people with the same ideas as you have, you're going to miss something and it's going to hurt bad. And I think we have examples of that right now in problems that we have in government. So that would be the things that I think we ought to remember. It's hard for me to remember it too, because I get excited or passionate or even angry sometimes at some of the things that happen. But I think you've got to look at it as people first. And it's okay to know somebody's worldview, but it's also important to listen, try to see the common ground that can be had.
Look, I love this idea that I find so many Americans really have the same objectives. They just have a different path to try to get there. And if we can realize those, that our commonalities far outweigh the things that divide us, we can make a lot more headway. Just two more quick things before I let you go. One, what are you learning right now? What I'm really trying to get to here is if there are books or YouTube videos or other media that you're consuming that you've found that's particularly inspirational, if somebody's kind of caught your vision, or maybe they're a Democrat or somebody on the left side of the political spectrum is like, well, Ben seems sensible. What's Ben reading? How am I going to learn a little bit more of this in a self-study way? Is there anything that you would commend to them that you're learning right now, either about education or about the conservative political movement or the way that you think?
You know, it's a really interesting question, because I have to tell you, I used to be a devotee of the Sunday mornings, and this has really just changed in the last year and a half to 2 years. I used to be a devotee to the Sunday morning shows. I used to consume, you know, mainstream media pretty heavily, and I still keep up with the news pretty well. But I have to tell you, I think that the only institution that is more out of touch with everyday people than people that live in Washington, D.C. is people in the media, particularly the national media. And I think it's a problem. I really feel like what I would challenge everyone to do is go talk to people that aren't opining on subjects. You know, talk to people where you have to pull information out of them. I think that there is a lot to be learned right now for the people that are not big talkers. There's a lot of struggle, I think, in the country. And we need, as people that are leaders and opinion leaders and public servants, I really think we can learn a lot by going to a flyover state and talking to what's the equivalent of a focus group, you know, recognizing that in communities that don't center around the political issue of the day, that people really don't pay nearly as much attention to race and tribe and creed and, you know, political bent, et cetera. They go to work, they do their job, their kids go to schools where there's people of all, you know, faiths and creeds and perspectives and ethnicities, et cetera. So I really have been trying to get my information more from what I would call primary sources. And listen, you know, you can do that a lot on social media. I think you have to have your filter up, because there's a lot of just false information that's out there. But I also think you can learn a lot, because there's a lot of thoughtful people who don't have a big microphone. They will type their thoughts out to you, and they can still have very reasoned opinions. And you know, some of them don't even have a college education. So I think that's what I would encourage is, you know, let's try to talk to real people and get connected to the constituencies that I think we all are very committed to helping, as opposed to getting our information from those that write about it and opine on it.
I think that's a fantastic note to end on, Ben. I think we could all do more to just reach out to our fellow man, have real conversations, and more than anything, listen and extract from people who might be reluctant to share their views, especially in the kind of political climate that you're describing right now, where, you know, unfortunately, oftentimes for my family, politics has to stay just off the table because it becomes a shouting match. And that's just a terrible spot for us to be in. And we've got to find some way to make this better. But I like your suggestion. Again, I just want to thank you for taking the time to come out and chat with me today. And I hope to hear even more about Epic Charter Schools in the future and hear your name as one of those people who gets their opinion out there a little more often.
Great. Thanks, Doug. I appreciate you doing this. I've enjoyed it a lot. And, you know, if I can ever participate in anything, just let me know. I think you're doing great work.
Thanks. You are listening to How Do We Make It Better? Check us out at bit.ly/HDWMIB. That's bit.ly/HDWMIB. I could not do these without the dedicated professionals at Sound4U in South Africa. They are behind the music and the mix and everything else that goes into making this podcast actually happen. They go above and beyond in every way, turning a simple recording into a true production. Thanks again.